Are we on the cusp of a paradigm shift? Hopefully, says Alec Ross. And if we don't, he says, the 2020s and beyond may well be known as the decades of rage. The source of that rage is the asymmetrical distribution of wealth to the rich and to the rest of us. In his book, The Raging 2020s, Ross points out, over the past 30 years, the top 1% have grown $21 trillion richer, while the bottom 50% have grown $900 billion poorer, and the middle class has stagnated. The source of this inequality, says Ross, is rooted in a philosophy espoused by Milton Friedman. That being shareholder capitalism versus stakeholder capitalism. According to Friedman, any company that was not maximizing profits was poorly managed. That philosophy led to wave after wave of assault on legislators in the United States to loosen up laws that hampered unrestricted corporate growth. As Ross points out, shareholder primacy melded perfectly with the Reagan and Thatcher eras, providing an intellectual cornerstone for deregulation and trickle-down economics, an economic approach that was crystallized in a line from the movie Wall Street, where the character, Gordon Gekko, says, "Greed is good." Fast forward to today, and the power and influence of multinational corporations has gone way beyond the power of the state to control them. Ross says the social contract has been broken and that greed is not good. In fact, it has taken us to the brink of rage. I invited Alec Ross to join me for a conversation that matters about rewriting the social contract between business, governments, and we the people. Alec, welcome. Thanks for joining me. You know, to quote
it's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, well, thank you. You know, I'd like to start by quoting Charles Dickens, who in A Tale of Two Cities said, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness." He was, of course, referring to the years that led to the French Revolution. I can't help but wonder, after reading your book, are we living in similar times?
We are in danger. We are on the precipice of tilting into rage as being our default political state. And when we have that, as I think we've seen evidence that, when there is that level of rage, it spills into the street. We saw this in France with the Yellow Jacket protest, the Gilets Jaunes, where citizens marched down the Champs-Élysées and trashed the buildings lining the Champs-Élysées and graffiti the Arc de Triomphe. We saw it in the United States with the attempted coup that took place on January 6th. We've seen it with protests from Black Lives Matters and others on the other end of the political spectrum. And so, I do think that if we don't rewrite our social contract, then we will see waves of, I don't know if there'll be revolutions or not, though they may, that we will see waves of violent protest. It reminds me, interestingly enough, the period it reminds me the most of is the 1840s in Europe, which was, for the preceding 40 years, we'd seen a lot of industrialization. And this was the industrialization of the Charles Dickens novels, 11-year-olds losing fingers in factories. And in the 1840s, we saw the largest waves of revolutions in Europe's history until the social contract was rewritten in a way that made industrialization work for more people.
Well, that social contract was rewritten, and it seemed, particularly following the Great Depression in the United States and the Second World War, that there seemed to be this understanding that companies needed to have a stakeholder role within the communities in which they lived and worked, that they had a responsibility to give back, to be a part of that community. But all that started to change. And as you point out in the book, Milton Friedman played a fundamental role in saying, no, that stakeholder capitalism doesn't work and it's not what companies should be focusing on. How did his thinking affect the way in which we have now grown to this point where multinational corporations are almost beyond the control of governments?
for the longest time, as you pointed out, if there was a big company in a town, that company would support the local sports teams. It would support the local arts councils. It would play a role philanthropically in the community, and it would oftentimes end up employing multiple generations of people from the same family. And if the economy went down a little bit, it didn't just fire people at the first sign of trouble. It held on and it fired people at the last possible instance. And in so doing, what they also did is they provided a strong local tax base. Then the University of Chicago School of Economic Theory took root, led by Milton Friedman. And this was sort of the ugliest side, the most ruthless side of capitalism, where it said, you know what, stakeholders, whether they are employees, whether they're customers, whether they're partners, whether they're local communities, whether it's the climate and environment, none of these matter. One thing matters, and only one thing, maximizing profit over the very short term. And what this did is this led to a sort of almost Mad Max-like form of capitalism, where businesses that were located in small and medium-sized towns spread across a country's interior, suddenly they all left and they went to tax-optimized locations. Then all of a sudden, the children of the CEO weren't going to the same schools as the children of the middle managers and of the janitors. And so we saw this physical dislocation of a company from its community. We saw an almost spiritual dislocation of people who had previously worked for decades in a company who suddenly, you know, at the first size of the wind change index direction, were either unemployed or turned into contractors or other such thing. Capitalism isn't one thing. There are lots of different forms of capitalism. And capitalism at its most ruthless, where it's only optimizing for short-term returns that are maximizing shareholder value, pretty much guts all of those who are not the holders of capital.
I have to tell you, in reading your book, and you were talking about how the local banks in your communities were, well, they were gobbled up and they moved away. They didn't have that face. I was on a cross-country trip this summer by car and went into one small town after another. And when I would get there, I would want to go to a local coffee shop. Very few of the smaller towns have them any longer. The multinational chains that we all know who they are all up there on the highway, and you turn off and go into town and the small local businesses aren't there any longer. So where is the social contract there? Because they're taking away jobs, they're taking away that local presence. They're not supporting baseball teams and football teams and so on. And these are important components of that social contract, and we're moving away from it.
And they aren't paying taxes either. This is what's remarkable. A year or two ago, a barista paid more in federal taxes than Starbucks, the entire company of Starbucks, because Starbucks, as a multinational corporation, was able to optimize its tax bill, incorporate certain things in certain places, engage in a lot of legal activity that should be illegal. But basically, what that meant is that some minimum wage worker, you know, who's made your cappuccino for you because you couldn't find a local coffee shop, that minimum wage worker who made your cappuccino paid more in taxes, not as a percentage, total taxes, than Starbucks Corporation. This is true for many other companies as well. FedEx, Federal Express. There have been years where a FedEx driver, one driver, pays more in federal taxes than the entire Federal Express Corporation. So yeah, so when we see this conglomeratization, and when they do pull out their investments from our community, and they then don't pay taxes into the system, what we see is actually, guess who ends up paying for all this? Middle-class people. Middle-class people are in this impossible situation where we are simultaneously subsidizing the social welfare programs for people at lower economic levels while also paying the taxes that wealthier individuals don't have to. And let me just own up to something for a second. Let me be totally transparent with the people who are watching us now. I'm now one of those owners of capital. I make more money based on the appreciation of the capital in my accounts than, you know, the amount that's deposited in my paycheck every 2 weeks. And what I've seen, as I've as my income has gone up, the percentage of my taxes that I pay for taxes has actually gone down, because we tax capital differently than we tax labor, and it should be reversed. But now that I'm, you know, among the elite, so to speak, in economic terms, I've seen with my own eyes, you know, this isn't some, you know, lefty revolutionary who's suffering economically, critiquing it from the outside. I'm on the inside. I'm on the inside. And I see that when you are an owner of capital in a significant way, it's a heads I win, tails you lose economy. And that breaks the social contract.
Well, and then it also winds up crippling the very governments that may have an ability to do something about that, because you're robbing them of the revenue that they require, or is required to be able to deliver so many of those social programs that we need to have. What do we need to do to stop this? Because, you know, this is not just in the United States. It moves across many jurisdictions, as you point out in your book, you know, tax evasion, cybersecurity, climate, pandemics, and so on. They metastasize in the spaces or the lines between jurisdictions. So what can we do, or do people in positions of governance need to do to start to be able to tighten up their ability to get these companies to participate in addressing these global challenges?
So what we need are laws and regulations that are harmonized across national boundaries. So we live in this crazy world right now. There are 196 sovereign countries out there. Those are 196 countries that get to make their own laws. Now we're in a world where, you know, we can push information, you know, on our cell phones. Our cell phones can send information in a click across borders. Similarly, in a globalized economy, we can send capital across borders in a click. The only way we stay out of a race to the bottom, and by race to the bottom, I mean, you know, wealthy individuals and corporations moving their capital into essentially 0% tax havens, is to create some systems between governments where we don't allow the sort of shell game that exists right now. And I got to be honest with you, the two of the worst countries in this respect are actually the United States and the United Kingdom. The UK with the Canary Islands, with the Isle of Man, with Jersey, with all of these little Caribbean islands that have become remarkable tax havens. And then the United States plays a very malignant role in this, because if you incorporate in Wyoming or Delaware, you can basically create enormous secrecy for your organization. So you can haven your money in one place, you can incorporate it in another, and the ability to actually get information, share information, and the ability to actually rightfully tax both the individuals and the institutions that are, you know, sort of our lords and masters in what is essentially a corporate autocracy right now. We need to fix those transnational systems.
How are we going to do that? Yeah, as you pointed out, there's 196 sovereign nations. Leadership is changing all the time. We see pluralism on the, populism on the rise. We see, you know, different leaders with different agendas. How do we come together to say, no, we have to, you know, find a balance that does not give so much authority to large multinational corporations, which have tremendous power and influence along with money?
Well, so I think that for everything that Joe Biden has done, both effectively and ineffectively since he's become president, the most important thing he's done, in my opinion, is get behind the concept of a global minimum tax. Now, there's this organization called the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperative Development, or something like this. And it is the world's 36 largest economies. So about 90% of global GDP are in these 36 companies. And there is an agreement right now that, you know, we all need to work towards individually and collectively. But these 36 countries have agreed to a global minimum tax of 15%. Now, that may not seem very much. 15% seems like a pretty low tax rate. But if that's the minimum, if there's a global minimum tax of 15%, then what it does is it takes the very worst of the tax havens, and where frankly hundreds of billions of dollars go every year, and subjects what is right now effectively a 0% tax to a 15% tax. Now, this is geeky stuff, but it's really important. Tax policy, it'll make, you know, it'll just sort of, your eyes will go to half mast. And so in my book, The Raging 2020s, I actually do a little case study where I do a, where somebody clicks on a Google ad and buys a belt, and I trace the taxes. I trace how the money flows in that transaction and point out how Google pays a 0.0% tax on that transaction, while the belt maker pays 40%, while the person who bought the belt pays 36%. But it's all through this tax havening. And if we eliminate the worst of the tax havens, then we go a long way towards solving some of these problems.
What can we as individuals, we the people, do? Because we are part of this equation as well. And right now, for many of us, we feel that we are being moved and manipulated around by corporations and governments that don't seem to quite comprehend what the impact of on individuals is. You know, when you won't even raise the minimum wage. But what can individuals do to help to write the and rewrite this social contract?
Well, I'll give very one practical example. You know, if part of what we want in our capitalism is for capitalism to work for more people, you know, not just the CEO and the shareholders, then one of the things that worked really well 100 years ago, worked up until about the 1960s, was the labor movement. Now, the labor movement in the United States and in Canada, in the United Kingdom, has sort of run into a ditch in recent decades. It's far stronger and far more effective in other parts of the world, in Central Europe and Northern Europe, for example. And I think that it is time for American workers and Canadian workers and British workers and others to say, all right, what is a union in the 2020s? What is a labor movement in the 2020s? How can those of us who are not the big shareholders and not the big CEOs benefit from the products and services that we're creating? Now, the way that this worked for decades was through what were then strong and not corrupt unions. Unfortunately, a lot of the unions today are neither strong, and too many of them are corrupt. You know, the two recent presidents of the United Auto Workers are in jail for fraud. You know, you're more likely to read about a union leader in the judicial system than you are to read about them having a successful collective action against a big company. And so I think in the same way in which we can innovate with our science and our technology, and in the same way in which we have startups that change the business world, I would love for us to innovate in labor. And I would love for us to have startups in the labor world, in the union world, that sort of change the game the way the Googles and the Amazons and others changed the game in the business world.
What about us as individuals? I know you're talking about the collective we, the people, but what about individually? What can I do to be a contributor in a way that, in the words of Gandhi, I live the change that I want to see materialized?
So first and foremost, it's participation. You know, if we, you know, it's not helpful to sort of close your eyes and ball your fists up and get very angry about things. At the end of the day, only optimists change the world. And so you do have to take some personal responsibility for this. So if there, what I would say is, across the issues that I write about in the raging 2020s, whether it's labor, whether it's taxes, whether it's climate change, stakeholder versus shareholder capitalism, whichever of those you're most passionate about, get involved. You can get involved politically. You can get involved through a nonprofit organization. But taking some percentage of your time and your focus and directing it toward a cause that you're passionate about. You know, ultimately, the opposite of love is not hate. It's indifference. And so when you just sort of observe what's going on and feel like you don't have agency, feel like you don't have an ability to shape the world around you, that's when we've lost. It's not when you're on the battlefield and you've lost a battle. That's not when you've really lost. You've lost when you've sort of pushed yourself away and said, I as an individual can't make a difference here.
Do you have a sense, this is just in our last couple of minutes here, do you have a sense that there are more and more large multinational companies that are beginning to grasp that they have to change, that they have to be a part of rewriting that social contract? You know, we look at the ESG, I want to call it the movement, because everybody seems to be jumping on that bandwagon. Do we actually see it play itself out through, you know, the issuing of green bonds and so on, or becoming B Corps? I don't know. But what role will these companies play? And do you at least see it starting to move in that direction with some of the major companies?
I do. Not with all of them. But I do. I'm very lucky in that I get to spend a lot of time with some of the world's most powerful CEOs. And I think that a lot of them, in their private moments, when they've got a beer in their hand or in another one in their belly, and they're being honest, they are recognizing that they aren't better off and their companies aren't better off if they're making an enormous amount of money, but the world around them is burning. And I will say that the one area that I see the realest commitment to in this respect is on climate change. You know, these CEOs recognize that if you're having a storm of the century every 18 months, it's not a storm of the century, it's just a storm of the year. It's breaking their supply chains. It's massively increasing the cost of raw materials. It's wreaking havoc on their bottom lines, in addition to on the climate and environment. And so I think where we can see the most real action, not corporate social responsibility, not PR, not kumbaya, not greenwashing, but the place where I am most optimistic about big companies taking the greatest level of responsibility is on climate change. And in fact, I would argue that in most respects, they're way ahead of government.
I hope you're right, because that I agree with you is the direction that we need to move in. You know, your book is beautifully written, The Raging 2020s. It's the sort of book that is odd to say it's a page-turner, but it's a page-turner. Really nicely done, very well written. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.